the Second Court of Appeals this morning. I'm Justice Gardner, and to my right is Justice Meyer. To my left is Justice Gabriel, and we welcome you all. I think that we have two cases scheduled for oral argument at on the 9 o'clock docket, and I'll ask the clerk to call the first case, and we'll go ahead and get started if you're ready. Okay.
The court calls the estate of Marjorie Abshine. The court is the court of Michelle will argue for the appellant, and Mr. Jim Hartnett will argue for the appellant.
Mr. Michelle?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Thomas Michelle and Kelly DeBerry, on behalf of the appellant, Ernestine Nichols, a proponent of the holographic will below, and also with co-appellant, Mr. Dave Bakudis, on behalf of Travis Avenue Baptist Church. We bring this appeal from the underlying order granted by the trial court granting a summary judgment. Both parties, as the court is familiar, filed competing motions for summary judgment on a holographic will written by an approximately 85-year-old woman. Both sides believe that the will was unambiguous and that the court should construe it in favor of the proponents as a valid will. The contestants, who are the appellees in the case here, contended that the will contained some precatory language and language about relating to as a rough guide for reasons for the will to fail. The trial court initially granted the will to probate and entered an order finding that the will was valid and met all the requirements
did
of Texas.
Did it find that it was valid?
It did, Your Honor. Well, it stated.
Found that it complied with the formalities and solemnities, but did it find that it was valid?
It said.
The contestants weren't before the court at that time.
I'm
thinking that the contestants weren't before the court.
They were not. They were not. But the will itself didn't change. The will was the same will, same piece of paper. It did say on clerk's record page 3, item 7, that the court found that the will and codicil met with the formalities and solemnities and under the circumstances required by law to make it a valid will and codicil. So I took that to mean it found it to be a valid will. In any event, the trial court also appears to have applied, in my opinion, in the proponent's opinion, the reverse presumption in the overwhelming guidance of Texas law with regard to the construction of the wills. This was in a handwritten will, entirely written by an elderly woman that said it was a holographic will, said it appointed an executor, an alternative executor, revoked prior wills, said it was disposing of her estate, and disposed in 100%, 50% to Miss Nichols, 25% to another relative, and 25% to her church. The Texas Supreme Court in McGill versus Johnson set forward the parameters when you first start looking at interpreting a will. And in fact, at page 687, stated under Texas law, several presumptions guide the interpretation of wills. A construction which would render the decedent intestate as to any part of his estate is not favored. If the language used is not free from doubt or ambiguity, then canons of construction may be resorted to, and that interpretation should be adopted which would uphold and not destroy the will. If we take those presumptions and apply them to the case at hand, I think it is clear that the overwhelming intent, which is one of the guiding principles this court must find, is that Ms. Abshine intended to leave her estate to the three people in her life, two relatives and her loving church. I think a critical issue that goes to the heart of the contestant's position is that the language was precatory, and they cite that in English law, precatory language is okay, and that American jurisprudence has rejected that and said that precatory language is not okay. However, that is, I believe, an overgeneralization and actually misstates the character of the law, and specifically this court, in 1968, specifically addressed the issue of precatory language. And in determining whether precatory is either language is precatory or mandatory, this court stated, where words of recommendation, request, desire, and the like are used in direct reference to the disposition of the testator's own property and show a clear intent to make such disposition, they are ordinarily regarded as imperative and testamentary rather than precatory. In this case, we clearly, when you look at the context of this will, and that's what we need to do, is look at the will as a whole. It looks like a will. It acts like a will. She uses the words, I'm disposing of my estate. I'm leaving it in exact percentages. I think it thwarts the testator's elderly woman's intent to say that that language that I would like someone to have. We cited a number of cases, starting from the Texas Supreme Court down, dealing with precatory language. In Bergen versus Bergen, the Supreme Court addressed the words like wanted or wish or desire, stated that in their ordinary meaning are precatory. These words, after construed as mandatory when used in a will or when it appears from the context of the will, that it is expressing the testator's expression of intent in making a disposition of property. McMullen versus Sims. We cited all these cases in our brief. They interpreted the word desire to mean mandatory and not precatory. Thompson versus Kirk. The words will, the words desire, the words want were mandatory, not precatory because of context. As I cited earlier to this court, Wattenberger versus Morris. The words desire are not precatory when used in context. They are mandatory. So it comes in contrast. The few cases that the contestants rely on, Haltom versus Austin, Huffman versus Huffman, and In Re Estate of Hunt, are all problematic in their cases. They don't deal with situations where the context you can determine what the testator's intent. Rather, in Haltom, there was direct conflicting language between different provisions, and that's how they resolved that. In Huffman versus Huffman, actually, they didn't have any language in it. They just said they handed a piece of stock to somebody, and the court would have to engraft and use different language. In Re Estate of Hunt, there was no language at all. It was just a gap. There was no language to interpret. It was just left the particular person out entirely. So in that case, they didn't even have precatory. In sum, when you get to the issue of precatory versus mandatory, as stated by this court and followed by the Supreme Court in numerous cases cited herein, the rule of thumb really is it's mandatory if you can look at it from the context. Here, we certainly believe that in the context, these cases indicate, which these other cases have followed, that it's mandatory and not precatory.
And no one has questioned the fact that she used the exact same language I would like with respect to nominating her executrix and...
Exactly, executrix. Exactly. In using the exact same language, the contestants took the position that was valid language, that was not precatory. They went before the trial court and said, oh, yeah, the executrix is fine, the revoking other prior wills is fine, the alternate executor is fine, all using the exact same language.
Yeah, my problem is that I'm having a problem with just as a rough guide.
I understand. Once again, I think if you employ the seven... We've outlined seven rules of construction in interpreting a will, all which favor a will rather than distant people this decedent has barely even knew. Remember, we quoted all those language of how distant really they may have met him as a child at one time. Take those presumptions that it's a valid will. You take the presumption that Texas law favors will. You take the construction of elderly women. We cited specifically cases of elderly people not using the most exact, precise language that there is. We think she resolved those conflicts by saying as a rough guide. We said that part could alternatively be ambiguous, Justice Gardner, saying as a rough guide, because we thought she also had what were found in her possession were her stock portfolios, which change in value from time to time. But it was our position that that issue as a rough guide was resolved by the more specific language that said as a rough guide, and then she uses exact percentages, 50, 25, and 25. And to throw out the will because she did her own handwritten will to say as a rough guide and then follows it up with a exact percentage, I think flips the presumption required by this court to favor testamentary disposition and not intestate disposition. And as a rough guide, at the most, at the very most, if the court were to be hung up as a rough guide, then that's at most ambiguous, subject to our ability to come in and try what she meant. We think she meant, if the court were to go that far, that she had varying degrees of estates and assets with regard to the market value of various portfolios and things of that nature. But given the parameters, and she also used the term, Justice Gardner, the disposition of my estate, I think you've got to put those in conjunction. She's disposing of her estate. Those are all construed, and it says one of the presumptions, number one that we list, is if at all possible, you want to harmonize the provisions of the will to favor disposition. That's construction number one. Number two, if there are different clauses, you want to harmonize the latter clauses to affirm a disposition rather than not affirm a disposition. And if the court can glean, follow the testator's dominant intent. You also want to interpret, this is number five we quoted, you interpret the beneficiary's getting the greatest possible recovery. Texas law provides, when you're construing these wills, Justice Gardner, and I think it goes right to the inner as a rough guide, the court is supposed to employ the construction that leaves the most possible disposition to the beneficiaries. So if you apply that rule of construction to as a rough guide, followed by distribution of my estate and the exact percentages equaling 100, that would leave the greatest disposition to the testamentary beneficiaries rather than the opposite presumption. We also set forth quite a bit of evidence. It was objected to at the trial court, but no order was entered sustaining those objections. Therefore, those objections were waived. But we also believe that if the court were to consider and should consider extrinsic evidence concerning the circumstances, one area clearly would be what was found, the will, the envelope that was in the will, how to write a will, all things that would go to the testator's intent of creating a will. I know it may be a little bit of overkill, but I mean, she called it a holographic will. She had papers on how to draft a will. It was all in her handwriting. Also, with regard to the lifelong friendship, that would explain the circumstances of her will, of why she was leaving the funds. She had no children of her own. She had a first cousin, our client, Ernestine Nichols, went to Travis Avenue Baptist Church. All of those factors, every one of them points to upholding this will, allowing the testator's intent to be realized and not going against the presumption and allowing it to fall off to some distant relatives. In sum, we would request that the court would reverse and render, because both sides filed competing motions for summary judgment. This court has the ability to enter an opinion and judgment that the will is valid and complies with Texas law, reverse the judgment awarding attorney's fees to the contestants, as we cited the cases that so allow, since we've reversed the judgment of the trial court. In the alternative, the contestants have asked for this as well. And the alternative, if the court does find that it's ambiguous, court reverse the judgment of the trial court, granting summary judgment in favor of the contestants, and remand this matter for a trial before the jury on the issue of the meanings of the will.
Mr. Michelle.
Yes, Your Honor.
What document would you suggest should be the guideline that the court chose to reverse and render for the disposition of the portion of the estate that went to Margaret C. Dennis?
That portion would be 25% to her because she's passed away, and that part would pass on per her representatives. Did I understand the court's question?
Yes, that's
okay.
What I'm asking.
Okay.
What document is there in the record that helps the court to understand how to make this position of that one part?
That's a good question, Your Honor. There may not be one. That portion, you could render that it's a valid will, remand portion of the case for further distribution to the heirs of.
I didn't see that in looking at
I think
evidence that was fully developed.
I think you're correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning. Jim Hartnett for the appellees. Jay Hartnett, Melinda Hartnett with me. Let me answer Justice Meyer's question first. We'll start at the back. There hasn't been, to my understanding, a formal determination of heirs. And so that's still open to be resolved by the court, both for that interest and the whole interest. You know, let me take you back to the beginning of this appellate process. What we've seen in their brief and what you've heard today is one jury argument. That's really it. They deserve it. We don't. It's more just to give it to them than to give it to the other heirs. These other heirs, the appellees, had no relationship with her. That's not right. That's not fair. Don't do it. Well, I'm sorry, but this is a question of law. And the reason we resort to that kind of jury argument when it's a question of law is because the law is not good for us, and it's not good for the appellants here. Well, absolutely you're supposed to uphold the will if you can legally. But you don't look at all of these outside elements, the relationships, in order to redraft a will that fails. We don't do that under the law. That's really what the point of the jury argument is to put a spin on the circumstances so that the court will skip the rules and say, well, it's more just that we leave it to that side. And the cases are clear that you can't do that. The Hangeman case that we cited and the Fuquay case that we cited, and I'll come to those again later, both say that it doesn't matter what a more just result would be or an obvious result would be.
I agree, you set that aside, but the, looking at the holographic will itself, does it not display a dominant intent on the part of the testator to leave her funds, her estate, 100% to the three people or entities named?
I would disagree with that because I think your Honor goes too far. A dominant intent, a desire, a preference, absolutely. No question. It's right there in the document. We don't dispute that. But the dominant intent is determined from the words used in the will. And the words used in the will as a rough guide shows that the dominant intent is not to do. It's not a command. Let me give Your Honor an example. There's no question that the three people mentioned in the will are Ernestine, Margaret, and the church. And if we total up the percentages, it's 100%. Well, as a rough guide, what does that mean? Okay, now the executor, who's the daughter of Ernestine, decides, well, I'm going to give Ernestine 60%, 70%. And I'm going to give you guys 15% each. Now, is that fair under the terms of the will? Well, sure. Under their interpretation, it would be. Because rough guide is just a rough guide. It means
rough
she can...
I think
you can stretch it and come up with an argument that, yeah, that's another interpretation that we can put on it. But you're, to me, if you do that, you're disregarding the plain meaning of rough guide. There's no indication that rough guide relates to will it be a percentage of one stock and a different percentage of another stock. I mean, we have to just... pardon me, lodge a pure guess to make that conclusion. That's what they ask you to do. They ask you to say, well, the percentages total 100%, so therefore we're going to just ignore the words rough guide. That's really what they've asked you to do. They've said that you should because the percentages come later and they add up to 100%. Well, what if the language was this? I'm not sure, but I think it would be nice if Ernestine gets 50%, Margaret gets 25%, Travis Avenue Baptist gets 25%. Well, that adds up to 100%. It's got the same people. We know her affinity for those people. But she says, I'm not sure, but I think it would be nice. Well, that's clearly precatory. And the only way we can fix language like that is to violate our rules and disregard language like, I'm not sure, but I think it would be nice. We have to disregard it, and here you have to do the same thing. You have to disregard as a rough guide. Now, to be honest, if Your Honor does believe that that is a reasonable interpretation under the law, then pretty much no question, you've determined that there's a latent ambiguity and you have to reverse. You can't render in their favor based on that interpretation, but you know, if your honor finds that it's ambiguous, then you would reverse it. But by doing that, we're substituting words, substituting a strained interpretation of the words used. And as a rough guide is an approximation. That's what that means. And to say, well, that only means a rough guide as to individual stocks is us putting words in to reach a more favorable determination. And what the Supreme Court said in Huffman, that we have to determine the intent from the will, not the will from the intent. And with all due respect, Justice Gabriel, I think that's, if we're going to try and come up with some way to minimize as a rough guide, then what we're trying to do is we're trying to determine the will from the intent, and we don't do that. The fundamental rule of interpretation here is that we look at the words used, and we deal with the harsh reality of those words. And we don't even get to these seven rules of construction that appellant tells you that you should look at.
Do you have a problem with the words, I would like? Are you primarily, if she had just said, I would like,
if she had
a problem with that?
If she had just said, I would like, given the rest of the will, that she had done that up above where she wrote holographic will and I name an executor, I think you would probably be able to find from the four corners of that document that it's a valid will. Okay. And that it makes a disposition. I would like is precatory language, but in the context of the four corners of the document, it can be held to be mandatory. It can be held to be a command. Their argument that it's a polite term has been rejected, but if you look at the four corners of the document and how they used it, yes, you could find that it's a command. But here, it goes way beyond that. The word guide as a guide is precatory. As a rough guide is even more precatory. Just as a rough guide is even more precatory, and just as a rough guide I would like is even more precatory than that. And so the only way this court can cure that for the appellants, the only way they can fix the injustice that they say is happening here is by disregarding the rules, by doing what Huffman, Hangeman, Fuquay tell us not to do. The Fuquay case, which is out of Amarillo, we cited in our brief, talks about how even though everybody thinks that the result is unjust, it doesn't matter. But now let's jump to their rules, their seven rules, which they say trump the basic rule set forth in Huffman. Those rules only come into play if there's an ambiguity. We don't create ambiguity by using those rules. The law favors testacy over intestacy. Well, that's sure. This will has intestacy no matter what. Margaret's share passes by intestacy. So we have intestacy no matter what. So the idea that we're creating some problem is A, not right, and B, doesn't matter.
Well, Mr. Clark, the circumstance that one of the named parties died after she wrote this certainly wouldn't be a contemplated act of intentional disposition.
You're absolutely right, Justice Meyer, but you have to remember that she created a will that did nothing but appoint an executor. She created a will that left her estate by intestacy.
Do you contest that the use of the word holographic will of Margaret B. Alger on the envelope was an indication of her intent to create a holographic will?
Do I contest it?
Yes, contest that.
No, I don't contest it, but it's...
What about the first line of the will that says holographic will of Margaret B. Alger? I would like to make you administrator. You don't contest that part, do you?
No, but I want to be clear what we're talking about in just a second.
I'm talking about the whole document. When you look at the use of the fact that the holographic will is mentioned both on the envelope in which the holographic document was found as well as in the will itself, then that indicates to me the clear intention on the part of this particular lady to write a will.
I would agree with that.
All right, and then if she uses the words, I would like to make, both in terms of naming her first independent executrix and also in terms of naming the alternate, I would like this used in two ways there to indicate that that's a direction she's requesting to be done in her holographic will as far as who's going to administer the estate.
I agree with that.
And so when you come back to what you don't agree with, it's the words just as a rough guide. That's where we fall off on your precatory argument, because that's the only language in the will that you would contend is precatory.
No, that's not true.
Okay, well, give me some other language that's precatory.
I would like, in the context of just as a rough guide, is also precatory under the law. The fact that I would like was used more clearly up above, I think, can make it mandatory. But the fact that it is used in conjunction with even more precatory language below still renders it precatory. But the fact that she wanted to make a will doesn't save the will. We find that in lots of situations where wills are precatory. If you look at most of the precatory language cases, and there aren't that many in Texas, but there are a decent number, most of them deal with simple bequests, not the whole will, not all of the dispositive, but merely one bequest becomes precatory and either passes by intestacy or by the residuary. And so very clearly in those instances, we have somebody that went to great pains to make a will, yet still used language that by law had to be found precatory. So the mere fact that the will is otherwise valid doesn't save the language at the bottom. But what I want to go back to, Justice Meyer, is your point that that, you know, nobody could have anticipated Margaret's death. And the other side talks about that fact in their brief. But when this woman wrote a will, she wrote a will that left her estate by intestacy. There's no question about that. You can write a will in Texas that does nothing other than appoint an executor, and your property passes by intestacy. And that's the will that she wrote.
Do you think that was her intent?
At the time that she wrote it?
Yes.
Evidently, because that's exactly what it says. Now,
so you think she knew at the time that she wrote, just as a rough guide, I would like, that was, she knew that was precatory language, and therefore it was meaningless, and her estate was going to pass by.
I don't know whether she knew that when she wrote that language. When she wrote the will, she would obviously know, if she was a competent woman, assuming she was, that the will made no disposition of her property. The first part. When she added the codicil language at the bottom, I don't know if she was telling the executor, you distribute it, you figure it out, but this is what I would like. There's a case going on down in Cleburne that I think should be going on here, but involves property right down the street here. And there, somebody is trying to let the executor figure out who gets it. Now, is that what's happened in this will, or is this her simply saying, this is what I would like you to think about? I'm not sure, but I would like for Ernestine to get 50%. For the church to get 25% and Margaret to get 25%.
She didn't say, I'm not sure.
No, but that's similar to what she did. What y'all have to decide is, are you going to disregard as a rough guide? You can't under the law, but that's exactly what they're asking you to do. I agree that this result may not seem fair. I'd be lying to you if I said, you know, this is perfectly fair. But we have law, we have rules, we have seen wills time and again where courts have addressed whether or not something is fair or unjust, and the courts have to follow the law. I'll answer any other questions you have, but I think I'm finished. Thanks.
I have a question that's kind of technical one, doesn't relate to the merits, but regarding the, maybe more the nature of the attorney's fees issue, the paternal heirs are not represented here? You represent?
We represent the paternal heirs.
Okay, the maternal heirs are not represented here then. What are they? Did they have an opportunity to participate and chose not to?
I think notice was given to everybody, and what happens in
a, to go back to the trial court regardless then,
there's going to be a determination of heirship to determine how the estate gets divided up. There's no question that that step will have to be done, okay, if that's what you're asking. But a lot of times in cases like this, one sibling will sit back while the other siblings fight it out and try to get the benefit without the cost. And that happens frequently in probate cases. I mean, we're siblings. If I had to contest my father's will and it was in their interest too as well, they could sit back and let me do it and spend all the money and try to reap the benefit from what I do. And so that's actually not uncommon in what happens in probate cases. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, hence the common fund doctrine.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Michelle, do you have a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
We're certainly not asking this court to reject the language. We believe we're asking the court to harmonize the language. It's a constant theme. We heard no details in opposing counsel's arguments. We hear some references to global statements about court's holdings. We went at great lengths in our brief to cite not only the interpretive language and the guiding principles language, but the particular facts underneath it. They do not support the proposition. They keep saying we see lots of cases. They don't cite any of those cases. We're not asking, the presumptions apply not whether the court finds them ambiguous. In McGill, the Texas Supreme Court clearly said we start with several presumptions regarding the interpretation of wills. We cited cases. First United Methodist versus Allen, page 31. The court noted that, quote, in considering informal language, which I think we would all agree this may be informal language, used by a layman who did not have legal advice in drafting his will, the court will not construe such language technically, but will do so liberally in the endeavor to arrive at the intent of the testator. We're not asking the court to reject the law. We're asking the court to follow the law. Next case, Anderson versus Dubel, D-U-B-E-L, page 32. She used language like, I want it that way. Please do this for me. Held valid, constituting a will, valid, binding, and mandatory. I can tell by the court's reading of this, everyone in this courtroom knows what this 85-year-old woman was doing, calling a holographic will, saying it's a holographic will, appointing executors, revoking wills, using the words of distribution of my estate. Just as a rough guide must be, they want to exclude it. They want to take just as a rough guide and throw it off all by itself and just pretend, oh, just a rough guide, that's what it means. That's not what it means. You have to place it in overall context of this will. It's clearly said, I want to distribute my estate in exact amounts to the single percentage.
Oh, wait, I had a question about the use of the term funds.
Yes.
With respect to whether that means just her funds, or did she really mean, did she have any real property? Can we consider that?
She did. It is our contention. They have not cited, I don't think they addressed this in the brief at all in their appellees. I may have missed it, but I don't see where they even touched on this topic. But with regard to the funds, we cited numerous cases addressing that situation. We found a Kentucky case directly holding that in the context of, first of all, funds can be broadly used. We've cited Texas cases, several cases on the word funds. But when we basically make a threefold argument with regard to that it should include real property. First, she's saying I'm disposing of my estate, which would include everything. Except she specifically excludes her annuities, which pass outside the estate because you designate your beneficiary on the annuity. Second, funds is a broad term. Third, there's no mention of the real estate. So we think when you put that in a combination effect, as construed probably by at least maybe half a dozen cases we cited, and specifically the Kentucky case specifically said in those contexts, funds includes the term real estate. So that would be our argument. Thank you. They don't, with regard to the precatory, I would like that we've got numerous concessions during opposing counsel's presentation, but it's not like we're asking the court to reject the will. We're asking the court to enforce the will in conjunction with the overwhelming body of case law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Michelle. Thank you both for your good arguments and good briefs, and your case is submitted.